Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Hey guys, you're listening to Crooked Conversations. This is Tommy Vitor, host of Pod Save the World and co-host of Pod Save America. My guest today is Gabriel Sherman. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair, but he wrote a book, the definitive book about Roger Ailes and Fox News. And I wanted to have this conversation because I think that we all know of Fox News and you know, every once in a while you accidentally flip it on and watch a couple minutes and are just appalled by what you see. But you really need to know Ailes' history and the history of his political involvement and the way Fox has been a part of the GOP establishment for literally decades to truly understand how we got to where we are today with Donald Trump as president. So much of the sort of that journey goes down Fox News.
For the people who actually turn out and vote in Republican primaries and the people who show up at Donald Trump rallies, he had already been, you know, a credible political voice, you know, going back to his years as a Fox News commentator.
It was a fascinating conversation. It's a hell of a good book. I highly recommend you get it and appreciate you guys tuning in to Crooked Conversations. Gabe, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tommy. Glad to be here.
So everyone listening to this pod, if you find it interesting and you want to learn more about Fox News and the genesis of Fox and Roger Ailes, you should read Gabe's book. It is a unbelievable page turner. And there's just so much that I'd forgotten about despite having lived in politics my whole life. But I wanted to start sort of at the beginning, because I think to understand Fox News, you have to understand Roger Ailes. And the beginning, like you had me tearing up, man. Like there were some, he had a tough upbringing in Ohio. He was a hemophiliac, which meant that even the smallest cut could be life-threatening because the bleeding won't stop. There is this, you know, anecdote where his parents are rushing him to a hospital and they had to get lights and sirens to sort of lead them there because they got pulled over. And it's just like harrowing story. But that vulnerability, instead of making him empathetic or more kind, it seemed to make him more aggressive and caustic and even violent. And I know, you know, at times I felt like he was like a good therapist away from Fox News never really existing, but you spent years learning about the guy. Like, what did you come away thinking about Roger Ailes?
Yeah, Tommy. I mean, that's a great way that you frame the question because, you know, on its face, Fox News is such a improbable, kind of almost unbelievable thing that a Republican operative would create what became the most watched cable news channel in America. It's kind of, as we were just saying, stranger than fiction. And I wanted to understand, how did this happen? How did this cult of personality get created? And everyone I talked to as I was reporting the book told me time and again that to understand Fox News, you had to understand Roger Ailes. And so as a reporter and a biographer, I decided I needed to go deep on Ailes's childhood and the arc of his life and where he came from. And in doing that, I went to Warren, Ohio, which is in Northeast Ohio. Roger Ailes was born there in May of 1940. And, you know, obviously now with Trump in the White House, we've been hearing a lot about the sort of forgotten communities in the industrial Rust Belt. Well, you know, Roger Ailes came from one of those communities. And, you know, that really explained a lot of his worldview. And in particular, he sort of cast himself as the product of this idyllic post-war America. But in fact, his childhood was incredibly dark. You mentioned at the top there his hemophilia. He grew up at a time in the 40s and 50s when the average life expectancy of a hemophiliac was about 11 years old.
Wow.
And from that experience, his brother and others told me, you know, he took away this incredible will to live and this force of personality that whenever people told him he couldn't do something, he doubled down on himself. And in fact, he told himself he could do anything. And on the one hand, those were very admirable qualities. On the other hand, he took away from his childhood this feeling that he would never be dominated again. He would always be in a position of power and control over others, whether it's through television or now, so subsequently we've learned, over women. And that was because of the product of abuse. You know, I obtained the divorce records that his mother filed in 1960 after being married to her Roger's father, her husband, who was a factory foreman. And the divorce records paint a harrowing picture of a household filled with domestic violence, paranoia, fear, and all of those qualities we now, you know, the sort of the darkness that we associate with Fox News. And that provided an incredible window into the formative years that shaped Ailes' worldview that he would take with him on his career in television and politics.
Yeah, and I should point out that, you know, he was ultimately fired from Fox for sexual harassment and, you know, was you know, there's all sorts of stories in the book of aggression from him towards women and towards people who worked with him, but also towards you as you were trying to report this, right? I mean, it sounds like this is about as intimidating a subject as you could have chosen.
Yeah, you know, it was one of these assignments, these reporting challenges where when I set out to write the book, I thought it was such a rich subject because there had not been a rigorously reported biography on Ailes, you know, which was, I found on one hand surprising given the role he shaped in controlling the Republican Party and transforming American politics into sort of a spectacle and entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I very quickly learned that the reason that there had not been more reporting on Ailes was that he took every piece of journalism about him as a threat.
Yeah.
And in my case, and it's not unique, he did this to other reporters. He hired private investigators to dig into my past. He had me followed. He set up right-wing smear websites to malign my reputation as a George Soros-funded puppet. A lot of times the smears were in not-so-veiled anti-Semitic ways. My wife and I, right around Christmas of 2012, got a death threat at our house, and we quickly threw all of our belongings into a bag, and we were going to go home for Christmas in a few days to see your family, but we decided just to get out of New York really quick that evening after filing a police report. So it was really this three-year period of living with fear and intimidation. And, you know, I think Ailes wanted to do that because he thought it would dissuade and prevent my reporting. But something about, you know, the way he was acting and the way he was trying to cover what I was just doing, which was just straight journalism, even convinced me even more that this was a real, that there was a story here. So it had the opposite effect. It actually motivated me.
Yeah, wrong approach with the wrong guy. So Fox, back to Fox itself, they brand themselves as not just news, but fair and balanced news. That's their spin. That's their branding, has been for a long time. But I think, again, it's important for everyone to understand that Fox's DNA is comprised of Republican politics, not a deep experience in news. Ailes got his start in radio and TV, but then he transitioned into a political campaign operative, and he never really left, even when he went back to television. He understood early on that, you know, the advent of TV meant political candidates needed to be performers, and I think that was sort of part of his genius. But, you know, again, for folks listening, Ailes went on to work for Nixon's presidential campaign, Reagan's presidential campaign, George H.W. Bush's campaign. He did work for Giuliani, countless other state officials, and it wasn't like he was a pollster. He was dictating some of the most vicious attack ads ever made. So, I mean, can you talk a bit about how that early campaign work shaped Fox?
Yeah, without question. You know, Roger Ailes had kind of the singular insight in 1968 when he was the executive producer of the Mike Douglas Show, which at the time was the number one daytime variety show in America, watched by 6 million people coast to coast. And his insight was that you could connect through television to viewers. You could go over the heads of what we now call the mainstream media. And so he applied that insight to the understanding that at some point television would become bigger than the Republican Party. Political parties were a vestige of the old machine era politics where you had to literally have kind of boots on the ground to turn people out and hand out leaflets and get your message out. But with television in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, during Ailes, the height of Ailes' political career, he realized that you could spread the message through television and transcend the party. And Fox News, as I report in the book, obviously became the controlling message organ of the Republican Party. I mean, it was kind of a false analogy. People said, oh, Fox News was the media arm of the Republican Party. Actually, mm-hmm. The book demonstrates that Fox News set the message that the Republican Party then had to follow. But that was Ailes' insight. His other insight was that the way to get votes was not through uplifting messages and kind of aspirational politics. It was through wedge politics and grievance. And that became the animating force of his political style. He did it, obviously, in 68 by harnessing the silent majority that Nixon was appealing to. Famously, in 1988, he did it with George H.W. Bush by turning that race into a race about race and patriotism. You know, famously, Ailes was quoted in Time magazine taking credit for the Willie Horton ad, mm-hmm. and saying the only question is, are we going to show Willie Horton with a knife or a gun? And also having George H.W. Bush campaign at a American flag factory in New Jersey, and basically trying to paint Michael Dukakis, the Democratic candidate, as this kind of alien, foreign, other candidate. All of the smears that Ailes and Fox News would then apply later to President Obama. But we saw that, you know, this was the DNA of a Roger Ailes campaign. And, you know, oftentimes he went too far. And the Willie Horton ad in particular in 88 really created a lot of baggage for Ailes that he never quite was able to shake. And it was partly that reason that he did not get asked to rejoin the 1992 Bush reelection campaign. And it kind of paved his exit from organized official Republican politics. And he had to reinvent himself in the early 1990s as a television producer, which then set him on the course to launching Fox News.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned how Fox wasn't the media arm, but they set the message. When I was reading the book, I was reminded of how much Fox drove the sort of patriotic fervor in the wake of 9/11 and during the lead up to the Iraq War. Ailes actually sent President Bush and his team a memo with advice about military strategy. Fox held internal strategy sessions to sort of like fine tune their coverage and help sell the war. They, in some ways, Fox News journalists conspired with the U.S. military to, you know, make the scene in Firdaus Square when the Saddam Hussein statue was pulled down look like it was a bigger, more euphoric event, when in reality it was, you know, several dozen maybe people in the square watching this happen. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the Iraq coverage. And if you thought, is that the area where they had the biggest policy impact, or were there other, you know, sort of policy agenda items that Ailes pushed forward?
You know, it's a great question. And you know, something I thought a lot about. And in some ways, I agree. And I'll first, you know, talk about Fox's role in the Iraq War, and then we can, you know, kind of expand and look at, you know, what it sort of try to assess what Ailes is at the whether that was, in fact, Ailes's biggest sort of policy victory. You know, after 9/11, what I was most struck by when I reported this book and interviewing the producers and executives who are inside Fox News and reviewing and looking at all the coverage was that Ailes recognized that the American people would have a visceral response and an emotional response to 9/11. Mm-hmm. You know, Fox News branded itself as the network that would cover the war in the kind of most graphic way. He introduced within hours of the attacks on the World Trade Center these blood red graphics that would cover the bottom of the screen. Fox News was one of the first networks to show those harrowing pictures of the jumpers plummeting from the towers as they burned, you know, kind of really in your face to stoke that sense of revenge amongst the audience was something that Ailes intuitively understood.
Yeah.
But what he also understood, which is so kind of both brilliant and devious as a political strategist, is that the response to 9/11, the American campaign in Afghanistan, which had widespread bipartisan support, would not be enough to sate the American people's hunger for revenge, because, you know, bombing caves and mountains in Afghanistan does not provide the visuals of a satisfying victory. And what America as a country wanted in Ailes' mind after 9/11 was a satisfying conclusion to this attack. And that is why you saw Fox News, in concert with the Bush White House, shift very quickly the conversation about America's response to 9/11 from Afghanistan to Iraq and Saddam Hussein. Because in Saddam Hussein, Roger Ailes found a Hollywood version of a dictator villain, an enemy that America could look to say, this is who we need to go after. And so Fox News quickly and unskeptically, you know, hyped the case for the war in Iraq by pressing faulty intelligence about WMDs. And that really put pressure on the rest of the media. And I think one of Ailes' lasting impacts and the sort of a signal for how much power he actually had was not only Fox News's coverage, but the way in which other networks felt pressured because of Fox's success to adopt its more jingoistic and right-wing style. You know, we should point out that Fox News passed CNN to become the number one most watched network in January of 2002, and it never looked back.
Right.
And it was in those months after 9/11 that we saw even MSNBC, you know, hire a whole slew and parade of conservatives to try to tap into this patriotic fervor that Ailes had helped whip up. And so I think the rest of the media, including the New York Times, which I've written about extensively, with their own flawed coverage of WMDs, sort of turned their skepticism off because the whole country was swept up in this response that Ailes had been instrumental in engineering after 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, I remember we were all scared shitless. People were telling us to buy duct tape and put plastic wrap on our windows. And you know, you have this amazing anecdote in the book about how a CNN bureau chief, I believe, or head of news, sent a memo down to his team that we needed to be more supportive of the troops. I mean, it was remarkable the way Fox was able to pull the entire press corps towards taking a less critical look at, you know, whether there was WMD and essentially cheerleading the war in some instances.
Yeah, without question. You know, one of the things I was most drawn to in reporting the book was when I realized that, you know, Ailes's particular eccentricities and idiosyncratic a response to, you know, we all were terrified after 9/11, but there was something in Ailes that snapped. And his latent paranoia, which had been kind of a constant throughout his life, kind of went into overdrive. And this was the time in which Ailes started traveling with his personal bodyguard. He obtained a concealed carry permit, which was very difficult to do in New York City. He would, in the years after 9/11, buy a hilltop parcel of land in upstate New York and build a compound with an underground security complex with a tunnel that would lead him out to the road below the mountain. He became, you know, obsessed with his own security. He told people he was targeted for personal assassination by Osama bin Laden. So it's like, you know, it's why Ailes is such a cinematic character in a way. It's his own particular paranoia and fear that he injected into the rest of the country.
Right.
And so, you know, we could have had many, many responses to 9/11, but because Ailes wielded the influence he did, America decided to set itself on that course of being a paranoid and fearful country.
Yeah. Crooked Conversations is brought to you by Quip.
Mm. Quip.
Guys, I've been using the Quip.
Me too.
But let me get to the copy first. Let me give you a challenge. Find a gift that's affordable, practical, and Instagram-worthy.
Not possible.
Doodle.
On the top of that list is Quip, the electric toothbrush that looks like it was designed by Apple, but without the high price. Quip is the new electric toothbrush.
Get away with saying that. Good for them.
No, good for them. That packs just the right amount of vibrations into an ultra-slim design with guiding pulses to simplify better
Tommy,
brushing.
Tommy, did you say you're getting just the right amount of vibrations? Would you say that it has a smooth deployment and a comfortable glide?
Quip comes with a mount that goes right on your mirror, fitting seamlessly into your daily routine.
Where do you mount the thing with the perfect amount of vibration, Tommy?
My God, it's a toothbrush.
Quip also offers an optional subscription plan delivering a new toothbrush head on a dentist-recommended a 3-month schedule for just $5.
There's so many vulgarities I'm skipping.
Including free shipping worldwide. And just in time for the holidays, Quip is the ideal size and price to gift anyone on your list. You can even include automatic brush head deliveries for a year to ensure your gift keeps giving
holiday. So you've been really enjoying this product with the perfect size and vibration for you.
I have to say.
What color?
Who cares what color it is?
Slate? Do you go with silver? Do you go with gold?
Yeah, like a white.
Cool.
But I have to say, my teeth feel noticeably cleaner.
Oh.
Hmm. I like my Quip. I went with gold.
Here's why it's perfect.
And I got Ronin a silver.
Three reasons.
Cool.
It's a gift they'll actually use every day. It's not something that's going to get chucked in a drawer. True. You don't have to go to a store to get it. They can ship directly to your door or theirs.
Again, we don't want anyone leaving.
Again, the unemployment office is just filled with middlemen. Just line out the door. It's that perfect $25 price point for those Secret Santas you struggle with every year.
No one in the Crooked Media office is just going to get a bunch of Quips.
Well, they can't because our Yankee swap is $15.
We're doing a Yankee swap.
You can...
I think it should have been 20.
The Quip electric toothbrush is featured in just about every gift guide this year, like GQ, Oprah's O-List, and Men's Health, and it's backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students.
Tommy, I have a question.
Do you think it made the O-List
because it's the perfect size and vibration?
Oh my God. I'm doing this over.
No, you're not.
Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. Quip starts at just $25, and right now when you go to getquip.com/crookedconvos, to get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/crookedconvos, spelled getquip.com/crookedconvos.
Sweet.
Crooked Conversations is brought to you by Dollar Shave. You guys, you've heard me talk about the amazing shave I get from my Dollar Shave Club razor, especially when I use it with their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter.
I love that Dollar Shave Butter.
Club.
No, Dollar Shave Club
you
and
put
the
that
Shave
on some
Butter.
Toast?
I'm here to tell you guys.
You're not supposed to eat it, you stupid moron.
I'm never giving up my membership. In fact, I'm adding even more Dollar Shave Club products to my daily routine.
What?
They make products for your hair, your face, your skin,
and
your shower,
else?
Your toast, everything you need.
Where else?
They have me looking and feeling amazing.
Would you say that you're a real one wipe, Charlie? Tommy?
It's all their own original stuff. They only use the finest premium ingredients. They deliver to you just like they do their razors. That means no more annoying trips to the store, cruising up and down aisles, looking at shelf upon shelf. What the hell is that? And what
nobody
do I do
go
it?
To the store anymore. We're just doing it all from home.
I do hate when the razors are like under lock and
key. It's the worst.
So silly. That's why we use Dollar Shave Club for just about everything.
Vault.
They got me covered head to toe, and with gift memberships and e-gift cards available, DSC can help cover the names on your holiday shopping list.
DSC
too.
For short, guys.
I'm reminded of the Chambord Vault,
guys. I want you to love Dollar Shave Club as much as I do. So I've arranged for you to try your first month of their best razor along with travel size versions of shave butter, body cleanser, and yes, even butt wipes for just $5.
They're what kind of butt wipes, John?
After that.
John, what kind of butt wipes?
They're One Wipe Charlie's,
One
John.
Wipe Love It's. After
no.
that, replacement cartridges ship for
one
just a few
Tommy.
Bucks a month. It's a DSC starter set. Get yours for just $5 exclusively at dollarshaveclub.com/crookedconvos. That's dollarshaveclub.com/crookedconvos.
Travel size butt wipes.
There are two things that are absolutely true. Grandma loves you, and she would never say no to McDonald's. So treat yourself to a Grandma McFlurry with your order today. It's what Grandma would want. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. At participating McDonald's for a limited time.
You brilliantly capture the way Democrats lurch back and forth with their approach to Fox. Sometimes we try to court them because we say, how can we leave out this audience? Sometimes we attack their credibility and freeze them out. I was with Obama when we tried both, and I've been of both minds about this personally. I screamed at Fox and Friends producers and other senior Fox producers so much that I had an out-of-body experience when they reported that Barack Obama attended a madrasa. And then when Anita Dunn was working at Obama as the White House communications director, you know, she said Fox was more of a right-wing organ than it was a part of the news. And then fast forward a couple of years later, and Obama is doing interviews with Bill O'Reilly on Super Bowl Sunday and the sort of most watched interview of the year. The conclusion I drew from the book is that courting Fox was probably a lost cause because of who Ailes was and what his goals were and how they were inherently political. Is that accurate, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think Ailes never was going to deal with the Democratic Party in general, and President Obama in particular, who he told executives wasn't born in America, and all of the smears and conspiracies that that were sort of prevalent on the right, Ailes believed himself. So he was never going to deal with the White House in good faith. And in fact, you know, the attacks on Fox by the White House, Ailes in a canny kind of move. And this is where I see the sort of failing of the sort of political press in D.C. You know, Ailes cast himself as a member of the journalistic establishment. And I remember Jake Tapper and others kind of crying foul when the White House revoked access to Fox News and said, you know, how dare you exclude a member of the Washington press corps from our ranks? And I think that's a big failure because I don't think, and knowing what I know, and I think the case that my reporting lays out in the book is very solid. You know, Fox is not a journalistic organization. I mean, they may employ some journalists, but it is a political operative. It's a political consulting company. It's basically Ailes' political consulting company that he ran in the 80s, transposed to the halls of a news network, and to sort of treat them like the rest of the press, whatever the failings are of all the networks and the mainstream papers, they operate, with the best of intentions to get the facts right. Fox operates with the intentions of advancing Roger Ailes' worldview, and that happens to be, you know, obviously largely in sync with the right-wing Republican conservative worldview. And so, you know, to engage with them as journalists, I think, is just being naive about what Ailes' intentions really are.
Yeah. That brings me to our most avid Fox viewer in this country, Donald Trump. I don't think people totally get the degree to which the Trump campaign was incubated by Fox News. These days, we know that he live tweets Fox and Friends, and he calls his best friend Sean Hannity after every episode, reportedly. But long before that, Roger Ailes had given Trump a weekly call-in spot on Fox and Friends, where he spent lots of time questioning Obama's birth certificate and citizenship and whatever other things he was doing. How much do you think that regular interaction shaped his future campaign message? And how much do you think that exposure benefited him down the road when he was seeking Republican primary voter votes?
Oh, without question. You know, the Trump-Ailes-Fox News relationship and that symbiosis was instrumental in actually making Donald Trump a credible political figure on the right. You know, Ailes and Trump had been friends since the 1980s. I mean, they were both New York City power brokers. They would see each other at the 21 Club and other places around town. And so, you know, they were acquaintances. And when Trump started his attacks on President Obama, you know, Ailes saw a savvy programming strategy because he knew, you know, Trump could get ratings. And he gave him, as you mentioned, that weekly call-in slot. And I think for Trump, he saw that message, the birtherism, the racism, the xenophobia, the bombast, all of that stuff was connecting with a wide swath of the Republican Party. And, you know, like we were just talking about earlier in the conversation, you know, the Republican Party took its cues from Fox News, not the other way around. And so by Donald Trump rolling out his kind of proto-candidacy in 2011 on Fox News, it gave him a viability so that 4+ years later, when he descended those stairs at Trump Tower to announce his candidacy in June of 2015, he was taken seriously by the Republican base. He might not have been taken seriously by the Republican establishment, and he certainly wasn't taken seriously by many reporters. But for the people who actually turn out and vote in Republican primaries and the people who show up at Donald Trump rallies, he had already been, you know, a credible political voice, you know, going back to his years as a Fox News commentator.
Yeah, and to your point again, like I remember seeing him on the Today Show doing similar interviews where he would opine about politics despite having absolutely no background or qualification to do so. So once again, Fox News leading networks around. So I guess my question that it sort of brings us today, which is what happens now? Roger Ailes has passed away. In many ways, he succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. Fox is a force in Republican politics. They drive stories. They create scandals like Fast and Furious and Benghazi, and they drive things into the forefront of news and the, you know, public consciousness in a way no other place seems to be able to do. But they're now facing this insurgency on the right from news outlets like Breitbart and others. Do you think they can hang on to the top spot sort of as is? Some people seem to think that Rupert Murdoch's sons are trying to moderate Fox after Ailes passed away. Do you see that happening, or are they going to have to go further to the right to stay relevant?
Well, I think there's sort of two separate ways to look at this question. You know, on the one hand, you know, cable news is a very mature business. The audiences are fairly stable. They're not growing. The average age of the Fox viewer, I believe, is something like 68 years old and ticking upwards. So this is an audience that, you know, as the rest of the TV industry is finding out, people are cutting the cords. It's a legacy media business. So on the one hand, you know, Fox still dominates the ratings. It generates billions of dollars of profit for Rupert Murdoch's media empire. So it's a very healthy business. But in terms of actually setting the agenda, I think that's where it becomes a lot more complicated. And I've, as a reporter, found a very interesting area to cover, the kind of fracturing and atomization that we've seen on the right in terms of the media outlets setting the agenda. You know, it's sort of ironic in a certain way that Ailes exploited the old media hierarchy to bust up the monopoly that the big three networks and CNN had. And now those same forces that splintered the media 20 years ago with Fox are actually attacking the empire that Ailes built. And so we see that with Breitbart. We see that with InfoWars. We see that, you know, with some of these, you know, we've seen Facebook pages that were set up in the 20s, the pro-Trump pages that were set up and perhaps were funded by the Russians. Mm-hmm. So we see the fracturing of the media on the right, just like we saw it in the mainstream. And I think for Ailes, it's kind of, he kind of wins both ways. I mean, he died earlier this year. But his legacy lives on because the kind of notion of relative truth and narrative over fact, and the idea that media exists to advance the interest of a particular political constituency lives on. And, you know, whether it's Steve Bannon or others, you know, we have the next generation of Aileses out there. Mm-hmm. And I think that is going to be kind of his lasting legacy, is that he's transformed media, especially political media, into just another form of politics.
Yeah. McKay Coppins is a great journalist for The Atlantic. He wrote this piece about how the right-wing media is essentially trying to destroy the broader media. He quoted Breitbart's White House bureau chief as saying, journalistic integrity is dead. There is no such thing anymore. So everything is about weaponization of information. He said later his goal was simple, the full destruction and elimination of the entire mainstream media. Do you think Fox is now a target for elimination too? Or are these lunatics at Breitbart talking about, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post?
I think it depends. I think if Fox sort of hews to the populist, nationalist, nativist wing of the Republican Party that Donald Trump exemplifies, I think Breitbart will direct its fire elsewhere. But I think to the degree that the Bret Baiers and some of the saner voices at Fox have say over the editorial strategy, or as you mentioned earlier, if the Murdoch's sons, James and Lachlan Murdoch, you know, attempt to steer Fox more to the center, then we're going to see Breitbart go, you know, completely a nuclear on Fox, because Breitbart is a sort of a is a pressure group, and they exist to keep the Republican Party driving rightwards towards the nationalist base. And so, if Fox is not on that program, they've become an enemy. So I guess it's a kind of wait and see about how Fox tacks.
Mm-hmm. What are those? You mentioned some saner voices. There's, you know, Chris Wallace, Bret Baier, some people that are, you know, more established journalists. What do they think about the fact that Sean Hannity is, you know, savaging anyone who dares to criticize President Trump and sort of acting as a pseudo press secretary? Like, do people get worried about the direction of the company internally? I mean, especially when during the election, Fox went through some periods where they were actually fighting against President Trump, and Megyn Kelly had that enormous blow up with President Trump when he said disgusting things that I will not repeat here about her. I mean, how do they manage this internally?
Well, you know, historically, Chris Wallace has been no fan of Sean Hannity, and they've had their off camera clashes over the years. And one Fox executive had described an email fight that they had, where in effect Sean Hannity emailed him to someone who viewed the email described it as saying something like, you know, Chris, the only reason you have a job in television is because of your daddy.
Nice.
So clearly off camera, these guys are not friends. And, you know, the Fox and Friends and the Sean Hannitys and that wing of Fox clearly creates a lot of agitation for people who want to at least cast themselves as a more sane journalist. But, you know, I think there's limited things that they can do, because unfortunately it's not Special Report that is generating the ratings at Fox News. I mean, the agenda is set in the morning with Fox and Friends, and it continues at night through primetime with the, you know, right-wing talking heads that they have. And so I think, you know, people like Wallace and Baier and Shepard Smith, Martha McCallum and others, I mean, I think they kind of hold their nose because they know what, you know, Fox's reason of being is, and they know their roles. And I think they they try to do, you know, on the margins what they can. And I think also, you know, in the case of some of those individuals, you know, they're paid very handsomely for their work. I mean, Ailes was savvy enough to know that he needed journalists on his payroll to trot out when reporters like myself or others wrote about Fox being a right-wing propaganda arm. He could say, no, 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 we have Shepard Smith. You know, he's criticized George W. Bush, or, you know, we have Chris Wallace. He asks tough questions. I mean, he used a lot of the journalists at Fox News as political foils.
Right.
And so I think that's the role that they serve. And I think, you know, whether they know that consciously or not, I think that's why they're paid. I think I've heard from sources Shepard Smith, you know, makes, you know, 8-figure salary. I mean, he's paid he's paid way more than he would be at CNN or MSNBC because of the value, the public relations value he provides to Fox News.
Yeah. My final question for you, in May, the Sinclair Broadcast Group and Tribune Media announced an agreement on a nearly $4 billion deal. That means Sinclair will own or operate 233 TV stations in 108 markets. Sinclair is a conservative news outlet, and many worry this is going to give them the power to politicize local TV news the way Fox politicized national cable. They've already hired former Trump administration officials to deliver factually dubious commentary despite having no real qualifications. So it's sort of well on its way to being problematic. My question is, do you think the creation of Fox News was an aberration or a singular event that succeeded only because of Ailes and timing and circumstances, or could Sinclair recreate it and become a similar force the way Fox has become?
You know, I think Fox News was a singular event. You know, Murdoch had the money, Roger Ailes had the life experience, the political experience, and then, you know, the unique genius as a TV producer and an entertainer to create this network. You know, as I report in the book, there were, you know, many other attempts to create, you know, conservative alternatives to the other networks, and they failed for a variety of reasons, either, you know, lack of financing, you know, the technology wasn't, the distribution wasn't, you know, ready for its time yet, or just, you know, bad programming. And I think the case with Sinclair, you know, I think the time will tell. I think one thing they don't have that Ailes did is just, it's not very good television. You know, when you watch Sinclair broadcast, you know, Boris Epstein and others, I mean, it really does look like public access TV.
Yeah.
And so the production is not, you know, Ailes at his heart was an entertainer. I'd say he's an entertainer first and a right-wing ideologue second. And he combined those two to create this kind of the synergy that had this incredible cultural power. And that's what Sinclair lacks. And so, you know, they may spread a conservative message far and wide, but from the stuff that I've watched, it lacks that kind of sense of spectacle that Fox News and those narrative storylines that Ailes was able to create that had such an effect on our national political conversation.
Yeah, I agree with that. Thank God Boris Epstein is not very good at his job, because boy, he is pretty stupid. Gabe Sherman, thank you so much. Everyone should follow Gabe on Twitter. He's a special correspondent of Vanity Fair. He's cranking out scoops like nobody's business. And if you like this conversation, you should buy The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. Thank you again for joining me.
Thank you, Tommy. Good to be here.
If you liked what you heard today, please rate us in the iTunes store. And if you have ideas for things you'd like to hear covered, please send us your suggestions on the Crooked Media Facebook page. We want to hear from you guys. Thank you as always for tuning in, and check back next week for more important conversations about things that really matter.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.